All right. The date is June 18th, 2014. I'm here with Tom Magnuson for an oral historyist interview with the Southern Oral History Program. All right, Mr. Magnuson, could you tell me a little bit about your family?
My immediate family here?
Your family growing up, your parents, siblings.
Yeah, they were both first-generation Americans, my parents. My father was born in 1897 on the way over from Sweden. And my mother's family moved here in the 1880s from Holland. I was adopted, and as was my brother and my sister. And we grew up in a little burg in Minnesota, real Huck Finn kind of town on the St. Croix River. It was an idyllic youth. And I got out of there as quickly as I could. And the opportunities were quite limited.
Okay.
I got my merchant seaman's documents when I was 14 and worked on the rivers and on the lakes for 2 years. And then went blue water out of New York. I got a Finnish ship that took me, had a crewman get injured in New York, and they hired me to work my way over to Europe. And I hung out in Europe for a few months and then decided to go back and go to school, and managed to find an American vessel with a missing crewman, and I had my seaman's documents, so they hired me, and I stayed on that vessel for some weeks. Went into Stettin, Poland, behind the Iron Curtain, this is 1964, and was very impressed by the deplorable situation in behind the Iron Curtain, and started to go to college, but really hated it.
Okay.
I was wasting time and money, and I was at the University of Minnesota, and had walked class across the Minnesota River, and there was a day when that wind was coming down that river and just ripped through everything you had on. And I got to class, and I had a graduate student teaching a bonehead English class, and I listening to him for about 15 minutes. I got up and I walked downtown, and I went in the recruiter's office and told the Marine Corps recruiter to get me to San Diego.
Okay, how old were you when you went back to school after the emergency image?
19.
Yeah.
Okay.
Did your parents or older relatives tell you any stories about how life was in Europe?
No, there was no active memory. My grandparents were, all four of them were dead before I was born, so I didn't get any of that. And furthermore, as first generations, they abandoned their European past pretty thoroughly. I mean, my dad grew up speaking Swedish at home, but quit speaking it as soon as he moved away from his parents, and he couldn't speak any by the time I was asking him about it.
Wow. How old was he when he came over?
He was born on the way over here.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, in actually, I think Erie, Pennsylvania is where his ship was docked and where he was recorded.
Was there anyone else besides your immediate family who lived with you in your home when you were growing up?
I had an uncle that lived with. He had been in the Marine Corps in World War II. In fact, I was his namesake. He disappeared in the Pacific, and so the family gave me his name. When he got out of the service, he lived with us for a couple of years.
Okay, very interesting. Do you think he sort of, I guess, motivated you in a sense to get involved in the military?
Yeah, I think so. He was a very impressive guy in a lot of ways, and not very militaristic at all. He was a very, very gentle man. And the only advice he ever gave me, he probably saved my life. And when I was getting ready to go to Vietnam, he said, don't volunteer for anything. And a couple of times I was tempted and didn't. I'm reasonably certain that that was a life-saving decision.
So what do you mean, don't volunteer for anything?
Well, the word, last thing in the world you want to have go through your mind is, I don't have to be here.
Okay.
And he had done it. He had volunteered for a particularly awful mission in the Pacific and had almost cost him his life. So that was his warning to me, and it was good sound advice.
Okay. So could you repeat where you were born?
I was born in St. Paul, Minnesota. My birth mother was in a foundling home. You know, she had me out of wedlock, so she was in a home for foundlings, and the adoption agency paid for her birth so they could have the baby.
Okay.
And I think there was some finagling going on, because 20 years ago, my birth family contacted me, and I found out that my mother's father worked with my father. The two of them worked on the Interurban Railroad together, which was a pretty small cadre.
Okay.
So I'm thinking that there was a swap, you know.
Yeah.
My folks were having trouble having babies, and I think everyone knew that, so. Mm. It's a good story, anyway.
Could you describe the neighborhood you grew up in?
Yeah, we had a state prison and the Anderson Window Factory. And Fred Anderson ran everything in the entire valley. And the neighborhood was all Anderson workers. We were just a mill village, really. We had the oldest structure in town. It was a trader's warehouse that had been erected in 1848 when Minnesota was first being settled by Europeans. And it sat above the floodplain. And the water got within 100 yards of the house one spring, but that was about it. So it was like I said, a very Huck Finn kind of place. We could go anywhere, anytime we wanted, generally speaking. We left in the summertime, we'd leave the house in the morning and come home at 9 o'clock when the siren went off, telling us that we were supposed to be off the streets. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of town it was. And wherever you were at lunch, that's where you had lunch. You know, somebody's mother was gonna feed you.
Okay. So it was a small town, Phil?
Oh yeah, 1,500 people, I think, including 500 inmates in the prison.
Did it change much over time?
Not until, well, after I left, it changed considerably, because Anderson's influence diminished, and Mr. Anderson died. That was a big change, and the character of the town, it became much more of a cultural enclave, kind of like Hillsborough, in the sense where it created an image of itself, and by golly, that's what it was going to be. And did a nice job of it. Wasn't much truth to it. It was a pretty rough town in its founding, so all that roughness kind of went away.
Okay, so when you were growing up there, the kids in the town would all play together.
Yeah.
Who were the kids you would play with?
Well, actually, I played with the North Side.
North Side?
Yeah, I lived on Central Avenue, and it was the middle of the town, and I'm on the north side of Central Avenue, so my friends were almost all from the north end.
Okay.
And then we would have wars with the south end up in the hills behind the town. We had foxholes and bunkers and stuff.
So what was different about the north side? Was it just like the central, or was there a different feel to it?
No, it was the architecture was much the same all over town. It was a pretty homogeneous place. Had two wealthy neighborhoods, and the rest was all working class. And the big difference was that the south end was mainly German. Hmm. And the north end was largely French, and which in that part of the world, when you say French, it's a euphemism for Native American. There were a number of mixed families up in the north end, and they all had French names.
Hmm. So what was school like for you?
Grade school was great. because I was kind of hyperactive and had the attention span of a gerbil, which I still do, and I had split classes. And I was always in the lower division of a split class, so that first and second grade were together, and third and fourth grade were together, and fifth and sixth grade. And I went through with always with the other, with the upper class, so that I could hear their material. So I was always well ahead in reading, and one of my teachers recognized this, and so instead of having me in a classroom where I was going to be a disruptive influence, she just sent me down to the library. So I spent most of my grade school in the library. I read every book in there, every encyclopedia. I mean, it was a real...
Wow, what was most interesting to you since you had free rein to all the different subjects?
Well, I think, you know, the grade school library. I had to go elsewhere for Candide. But it was just the science, a lot of science. I sucked up a lot of science. And high school was, I was a jock, and as a result, I didn't take very much very serious.
Okay.
Yeah.
So thinking about traveling, just around your neighborhood, how did you get to school?
I walked to grade school and junior high school.
How long of a walk was that?
Three blocks?
Yeah. Okay, that's not so bad. And then for your family, like buying groceries or running errands?
Well, you know, the groceries were delivered then.
Okay.
You just phone your order in and the truck would show up with your groceries. We got a supermarket finally in the 50s, red and white, but we still use the groceries because they're, you know, much more convenient. And we had, in that town of 1,500 people, we had three groceries and a bakery and a supermarket. So you had plenty of choices. And Archie Stenland's grocery store was the closest one to our house, and he had the best candy. Little jars stuck up in the wall, and you take the lid off and reach in and grab some candy. He's always chucking candy at us.
Okay. So it was very communal.
Yeah. And everybody had the right to cuss you out. And the old guys, the ones that, this was a logging town. It was really rough. And there was one old guy there, his name was Slab Byers. And Slab was named that because he's tough as slab wood. You ever seen a sawmill? When you slab the side of that tree, that wood that gets tossed aside and it's too rough to use, that was Slab Byers.
Okay.
And Slab was a millionaire because he started working in the woods and then discovered that cutting ice was a more valuable thing. So he set up an ice gantry next to the railroad tracks and fed the Northern Pacific ice all winter long because the river would freeze 3 feet deep out in front of our town. And when you were 14, you could go to work on the ice gantry.
Nice. So
I got in the last year before they shut it down.
Did you enjoy that?
Oh gosh, yeah.
Yeah.
It was manly work, and you were hanging out with guys. And frankly, if you were working full time on a man's job, the bartenders didn't ask anything.
Okay.
Everybody knew who you were.
Yeah.
You couldn't walk into a bar and fool anyone, full of people that knew you, so.
Uh-huh.
But when I went to work in the Anderson Window Factory when I was 15, I went in that bar, somebody said, let's go get a beer, and on the way home, we were working swing shift, and about 11 o'clock at night, something like that. And the bartender set the beer up for me, and one of the guys at the bar said, you're Tommy Magnuson, you can't be in here, you're not old enough. And the bartender said, he just did a full trick at Anderson's. He gets to have whatever he wants.
Interesting rules.
Yeah. And it used to be, the cops in that town, if you were drunk, they'd give you a ride home. You know?
Wow. That, when was this? When did you start working there? What year?
Anderson's?
Uh-huh.
Would have been 56.
56.
Well, actually, I went to work for Mr. Anderson in his yard and on his boat when I was 11. When I was 10, I got my first job. It was in a dry cleaning shop, sweeping out the cuffs and the pockets. Mm-hmm. I could keep anything under $5.
Oh, wow. That's a pretty good gig.
Yeah. So then I got a job with Mr. Anderson as a yard boy and a boat boy. And I worked for him until I was 14. I went and asked for a raise. And he said, what do you need a raise for? I said, well, I'm worried about going to college. He says, I'm going to give you good advice. He said, don't ever worry about anything. Worry spoils your appetite and wrecks your breakfast. By dinner time, you've been worrying about the wrong thing all day anyway.
So I imagine.
And no, I'm not going to give you a raise. You're fired.
Oh, no.
It was cute.
Yeah. So I imagine he was a pretty big figure, though, in the town.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was the water walker.
What did people think of him?
Ranged from adoration to detestation, as usual, when you're in a position of power, you know.
Yeah.
You couldn't buy a house in the St. Croix Valley. The entire valley was under the St. Croix Land Company. Every mortgage had to go through the St. Croix Land Company, and that was him. And you couldn't buy a house if you were a Jew or black, or I don't think Native Americans could unless they were totally assimilated.
Wow.
So yeah, Fred was a pretty harsh man that way, but every year he'd take his employees out on his yacht, and that's, you know, upwards of 2,000 employees, and he'd stand at the head of the gangway and greet each one of them personally, knew their names, knew their wives' names, knew their kids' names. Just amazing memory, but also management. He introduced profit sharing in that company in 1913, so it was the most sought after job anywhere in the region. You know, people came from 100 miles away to try to get a job there. And on profit sharing days, guys would show up in rented Cadillacs and limos, you know, to pick up their profit sharing check, because that was about anywhere from 50 to 100% of your salary. I mean, it got to be such a big deal that television crews from the Twin Cities would go over on profit sharing days and watch the Anderson employees pick up their checks.
Wow. And so you saw a lot of this when you were just growing up and stuff.
Yeah.
Interesting. What kind of role did religion have on your childhood experiences? Was church something everyone went to?
Yeah. Done deal. Sunday school every week. Mother would burn a roast. You could smell it a block from home when you were walking home from church. I actually mandated my kids had to go to Sunday school for a couple of years as an inoculation. Yeah, I remember we had three main churches. There were some sects meeting in people's basements, but there was a Lutheran church, there was a Catholic church, and there was a Congregational church, and that was it, pretty much. You had to go out of town to find a Methodist.
And what kind of church did you?
Congregational.
Congregational?
Yeah.
And you guys would walk there?
Yeah.
As well?
Yeah.
Okay.
All the churches were within 100 yards of the school.
Okay. I'm getting a sense it was a pretty small place.
Yeah, yeah. And the Catholic priest, Father Miller, wouldn't allow the Catholic Boy Scouts to go to a Lutheran or Congregational church on Boy Scout Sunday, and that just about tore the town up.
Is that right?
Yeah.
How did people react to that?
Oh, they're, you know, damn papists. Mackerel snappers.
Okay, you mentioned a bit about race when it came to home loans and things. How was it on a day-to-day basis interacting with, you know, people of other races when you were growing up?
We didn't. When Brown versus the Board of Education appeared in the Weekly Reader, my parents drove me 20 miles to St. Paul to see an elevator operator at the Dayton's store. You could also find some black folks fishing off the sewer outlet, fishing for carp.
Wow.
Up in Stillwater, 5 miles away. Every once in a while they'd drive over from St. Paul. But I'm telling you, it was lily white.
That's a common thing I think I hear when people, you know, experience these.
Well, and the racism was as profound as anything you could find in the South.
Okay.
It's just that they didn't have any reason for it, because there was no black folks anywhere near her, you know.
So how did you know? How did you know the racism was so alive there?
Well, my brother was just a horrible racist, you know. It was all about mud people and just ridiculous. You know? My parents were closet racist. I think my mother told me once, oh, those people wouldn't want to live here. They'd like to be with their own. So, yeah, it was pervasive. But the fundamental argument of the 50s that swayed almost all of the young people I knew was what they can do to the least of us, they can do to any of us. That was the argument that was put forth for why we have to integrate and why we have to kill Jim Crow. Mm-hmm. Was if it can be done to them, it can be done to you. Okay. And World War II is still so fresh in everyone's mind that it was undeniable.
Okay, so are there any particular recollections you had about your childhood that, you know, you would say impact the way you think about race? Any particular moments where it became something you thought about or, you know, sort of shaped?
Yeah, in 1955, his name will come to me in a minute. It's been that long. At any rate, the head chef at the state prison was a black dude, and his nephew from Atlanta was sent to live with him while there was rioting in the streets in Atlanta. His parents were afraid for him at school, so they sent him to live with the uncle, and he and I became pals. I'd walk him home from school every day.
And who was he?
He was just a kid from Atlanta, you know, this was like fifth grade, I suppose.
And how did your other friends and your family react to hanging out with him?
Some people, you know, I'm sure gave him crap, but he was, generally speaking, left alone. And it just happened that I decided I wanted to learn more about his experience.
Okay.
And that's as chummy as we got. We walked through the town together. It was about a half mile from the school to the prison, maybe three quarters of a mile.
Okay, so what kind of work did your father do?
He was a town maintenance supervisor, electrical and plumbing, or electrical and water and sewer. Saturday mornings, one of the chores that we had to do is ride around with Dad and find burned out street light bulbs and replace them and hose down the sewage treatment plant with high pressure hoses. That was every Saturday when we were home.
Does your mother work?
She started working when I was 10, I think. She went back to nursing, and they adopted my sister, and there was a recession going on right then. You know, the money was really hard to come by, so she went back to nursing, and she continued that the rest of her life. She ended up fairly high in the hierarchy of geriatric care, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And when did you start working yourself? Was that with Mr. Anderson?
No, it was a year before that with Bob Maurer's dry cleaning shop.
Okay.
Mr. Maurer was a shop teacher in the junior high. So he was trusted to supervise me during the day.
So he was he taught the class and he had the dry cleaning?
Yeah. Yeah, there's no way for a teacher to make it on teacher's salary, so they, you know, either had a business outside the school or else they had a summer business like painting houses and stuff.
And this was in the early 50s?
I started school in 49. So yeah, I was done with grade school. Okay. Mid 50s, late 50s.
Okay, so starting at the dry cleaning shop, would you mind speaking about your career trajectory leading up to the, I'm just kidding, to the Trading Path Association? Yeah.
Well, let us say it was not a straight line. It kind of was, in a way. I wasn't a real happy kid. I, in retrospect, found I was probably pretty depressed. And I wanted to get away, so starting at 13, 14 years old, I started hitchhiking. on a weekend. I'd stick my thumb out and I'd hitch all day Saturday, and then hitch back on Sunday. You know, and then
where did you go?
Anywhere, just whatever direction I was headed. You know.
How far do you think you went when you were that young?
Oh gosh, in the summer that I turned 15, I hitchhiked to Seattle from Minnesota. I wanted to see Skid Row. They were going to tear it down to put up the Space Needle. That was the Seattle World's Fair. Purpose was to get rid of the bums, the hobo jungle. They had the biggest hobo jungle in North America on that land where the Space Needle is now. And I wanted to see it before they destroyed it. So I hitchhiked out there. I carried a letter from my county sheriff saying I was of good character and that my parents knew that I was traveling. Please give him every assistance. So there was more than one night I spent sleeping in jail cells that the cops would just let me have a bed.
Interesting. So you hitchhiked after that as well, didn't you?
I hitchhiked about 250,000 miles by the time I was 18.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then where did you go? What were some highlights you think of?
Well, the first time I went to California, I was 15. Yeah, I was 14 when I went to Seattle, and I was 15 and I hitchhiked down to California, and then just for giggles, I hitchhiked from California to New York and then back to Minnesota to see if I could do it. I think I hitched out to California 3 times during high school, because of course that was a place to be.
Was this something you think a lot of people were doing at this time?
No, everybody said, oh God, that's too dangerous. But one of the most liberating experiences of my life was when I was 14, I wanted to get my Merchant Seaman's documents, and in order to get them, you had to go through hell. It was just a catch-22. You know, we'll give you your document if you have a ship. We'll give you a ship if you have your document thing. And so I had to go to Chicago to get a letter from the Seaman's Union saying that if I had a document, I could get a ship. And I was hitchhiking down to Chicago and got picked up late in the evening by a very gay gentleman. And he hit on me pretty seriously. He was offering me an apartment on the north side of Chicago and stuff like that. The offer was getting tempting, so I told him, I said, no, I can't do that. You're going to have to let me out at the next stop. Just pull out in the next truck stop and dump me. And he stopped and he told me, he said, if a gay person ever hits on you, all you ever have to do is say, no, I'm straight, and they'll leave you alone. And I tested it, and it worked. Mm-hmm. I never had a problem with a gay person ever again. You know, the fear went away.
Okay, so that was your biggest worry, I suppose, being young and hitchhiking, dealing with men and maybe...
Yeah, you never knew.
Sexual predators, really.
I'll tell you, one of my defense mechanisms, and it irks my wife, is that I learned while hitchhiking to mimic accents and speech patterns.
Mm-hmm.
So you hear the person and you feed back to them what they're saying. It works great in graduate school, but, you know, because that's what professors want. They want to hear their voice, and they want to hear their vocabulary and stuff like that. And I learned to do that hitchhiking. I would give them their accent, I would give them their vocabulary, just to ingratiate myself or defense as a defensive mechanism to make them not fear me. And that's been useful all my life.
Interesting.
My first publication is a chapter in a book called Hey Now, Hitchhiker.
Hey Now, Hitchhiker.
Hey Now, Hitchhiker.
When was that published?
Some guy published it back in the, I suppose, 60s. He contacted me. He had heard about my hitchhiking and asked me to write a chapter on how to get a ride. There is my first publication. We're already on the trajectory to authoring history.
Yeah. So I guess in more ways than one, your experiences hitchhiking had a pretty profound impact,
yeah.
I imagine, on what you do now with trading paths in particular.
I don't know. You know, I tend to think that I've always been interested. That is, when I was a kid, I found an old road up in the hills behind town. And I took my dad up to look at it. He said, yeah, this was the original entrance road to the town. There was a, what I found was a ford that was overlaying with human beams, which is the first time anyone in Hillsborough, in Bayport, had seen one of those. And Dad, you know, explained it to me. And I've always had that interest. You know, what was it like before? What are the infrastructure items? The neat thing about infrastructure is it's not racial. It has nothing to do with gender or wealth. It's neutral, totally neutral. But it also gives you insight into all groups. Here's where they had to go. You know, this is what they had to deal with. No matter, and infrastructure is that way. Everybody's got to use it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So, thinking about what you do now with infrastructures and pathways, particularly with the Trading Path Association, how would you define your working, your work, basically?
Cheap thrills and easy amusement. One of the things I've learned, and this is a valuable lesson in life, is if it ain't fun, don't do it. My definition of a calling is something you can't not do. You know, if you do it reflexively, if it's just a part of your life, there's your calling. Go ahead and do it. You know, if you can't make money at it, big deal.
Yeah. Okay. So, when you start a new project with Trading Paths, there's a new, I guess, pathway you've discovered, or someone wants you to come check it out and, you know, use your expertise to sort of make sense of it, or maybe to find something. What are your first steps?
I stumbled into it. I was studying military history at Duke, and my mentor had me reading geopolitics. I had two small children and no income, so we couldn't join a swimming pool up in Person County, North Carolina. Person County was a bit backwards, you know, even by Oxford standards. And anyway, we ended up swimming in the Flat River, and I found a series of pools that were pretty cool. And then I realized they were mill ponds, blown out dams. And then it dawned on me that those cuts in the hillside were roadbeds. And with that realization, dawned on me that the Piedmont is geopolitically governed by river crossings. That is the key to strategic control of the Carolina Piedmont, is to control river crossings. And the big realization was, oh, you can find these things. There's geophysical earmarks of where you would have a fort. And if you can find them, then you can know where all the archaeology is, or at least the vast preponderance of your archaeology is going to be within meters of the center of that roadbed. So that was the realization, the aha moment. And then I looked into it. I did a business plan, which was so depressing because there was absolutely no way to make it pay. Pay for itself. And I would revisit that business plan. I did that in the 80s, and I would revisit that business plan. It was called the Piedmont Fords Project. And couldn't find a way to make it work, couldn't find a way. And then in the 90s, the Park Service changed its standards for what's preservable. They started preserving landscapes, viewscapes. And I said, this is a viewscape. These are landscape features, you know, so it's possible. I ran the numbers and I said, yeah, it's possible if I can get grants. And so that 1999, I started the Trading Path Association because I thought fords were too parochial and obscure. People wouldn't know what a ford is. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, in the 80s, when I finished up at Duke, my research question when I went to Duke was, why do so many reasonably intelligent, well-motivated people fail when it comes to military affairs?
And what were you doing at Duke?
I was doing a military history degree.
Military history.
And I was trying to figure out how we screwed the pooch in Vietnam. Mm. And why is it we couldn't see the fatal flaws, the defects. Why is it we still didn't see them after the effect? You know, that the failure analysis was so totally wrong. And so that what I was studying really was the doctrinal process. How does the profession learn, and why doesn't it learn when it doesn't learn? After I finished that, the Marine Corps engaged me in reforms on the Marine Corps. Again, romantic story. When I was in Vietnam, there was a really, really cool officer. The guy was charismatic as all get out, and he became my godfather, my Dutch uncle. He would keep me out of trouble, and I was his scrounge. If he needed something, I knew where to get it, and I'd get it for him. And long story short, I noticed a squib in the newspaper saying A.M. Gray has taken over as commander down at Little River. I called his office and asked his secretary if that was Al Gray. He said, yeah. I said, would you see if he'll talk to Tom Magnuson? And he came on the phone. He said, I'm not paying any bail, Magnuson. And he hired me to work on the reforms, and that's what I did for about 4 years in the 80s, until he and I had a falling out over the Osprey.
Is there anything else you want to add about the military, and I guess your interest in it? You went on to do military.
Well, I was only interested in figuring out how to avoid the stupidity that we exhibited in Vietnam, which obviously I failed. there was a big battle in the 80s, the 70s and 80s, over the soul of the military, exemplified by two books. There was a book by Samuel Huntington, which proposed that the heroic warrior ethos should govern the military, and it should be separate from society as it is now, and that's exactly what we got. Opposite to him, opposing him, was a guy named Morris Janowitz. And Janowitz argued that doing so would result in a disastrous schism in society, where the society would be militarized and simultaneously lose any knowledge or interest in the military, which is what's happened. So I was fighting against the all-volunteer force for a number of years, and lost that fight. So I wasn't really tied to the military any longer, and was at that point had enough experience with startup businesses and writing business plans that that's what I did. I became a consultant to startups, and I wrote business plans. And a company from Australia adopted a business plan and then asked me to implement it. So I spent 3-4 years flogging their computer-based training programs. And then the kid I hired to help me for that, it turned out to be a genius programmer, just world class. Self-taught, his cousin taught him how to program him. From Oxford, or Creedmoor rather, you know. And he's got an idea for a business, and he gets screwed by everyone. You know, he gets partners that rip him off, his clients are ripping him off. So he asked me to manage his business. And what we did is we created in the 90s a virtual company. He was in San Diego. We had one partner in London, one in Seattle, one in Moscow, and I was here. And I was the managing partner, and we sold NT problem solving, you know, NT solutions.
NT?
Yeah, the Windows NT, their server software.
Okay. Well, you've had quite a work history.
Oh, yes. You can't hold a job.
Sounds like you've done some interesting things.
Yeah, they've all been interesting. If it isn't fun, don't do it. And I got out of that two reasons. One, the Park Service made that change, and I told the guys I had to leave, but I also was getting old enough that I couldn't keep up with the technology anymore. It was just blowing me away. It was depressing, but the fact is, you know, you can only change your paradigm so many times before the system collapses, I think.
Right. Yeah. So you So you were doing some technical stuff in the military too?
Yeah.
That's where you started.
The military trained me in electronics. And then when I got out, I went to college and I got my first degree in electrical engineering and decided I wasn't going to be a happy engineer. But I was working in the integrated circuit industry to pay for school. And I tried law school for a couple of years. Decided I was never going to be a lawyer. And at that point, I'd been in the integrated circuit industry for about 3 years. And the U.S. Navy hired me as a procurement officer for the Fleet Ballistic Missile Program, the Special Projects Office, buying electronics for the A3, C3, D4, and D5 missiles. And then I got into logistics. I love logistics. I think I could have been happy in logistics if it wasn't for working for the government. My buddy and I sat down one day and we calculated exactly where we would be, where our houses would be, and where our careers would be for the next 20 years.
Wow. You didn't like the predictability of it?
God, no. Nor the what you had to do to get it. The way you get promoted working for any defense program, I'm sure that any office in the government, is you increase your budget. You get paid proportional to the amount of money you manage. Fundamental progressive policy realized in the 1890s that guys will take bribes if they don't get enough money. So you're always paid proportional to what you make, and your boss is too. And your budget goes up, his budget goes up. So if you want to make yourself popular around the office, you just find ways of bringing more money into your budget. And that's fun. It's a lot of fun, but it's corrupt as all hell.
All right, so could you talk about, I'm switching gears a little bit, how you came to Hillsborough?
When I came to Duke in 78, my buddy and I both quit the Navy office at the same time. He went on to law school. I came to Duke to study with Rop. And first place I came in North Carolina was right here, Hillsborough.
Why is that?
Oh, just it looked good. It was the same size as the town I grew up in.
Okay.
It had kind of the same ambiance in a way, but it was a boss hog town. It was two brothers ran the place. The chief police and the mayor were brothers, and you could get a permit to do anything in this town. There was no security for homeowners whatsoever. So I bought a place up in Person County. Coming from California, I had to buy much more than I needed just to avoid capital gains. I bought an 8-acre farm up there, and it was a great place for my kids too. I was always feeling guilty about taking them away from their pals, so I bought a place that I thought I'd like if I was a kid.
Okay. How old were your kids when you moved out here?
Five and two.
Oh, they're young.
Yeah.
Okay. And compared to California, what was your reaction to the sort of social climate of Hillsborough?
At that point, I had lived on three continents, in combat, in I've been in Africa for months on end, and Europe, but I had never suffered culture shock quite like I did moving here. I thought the thing is, it looked so familiar. Looks like the same, but it wasn't the same. And it was a long time before I could just accommodate the fact that I'm never going to understand this place.
You still feel that way?
Oh, yes. Well, it kind of helps. A historian should never think he understands anything.
Yeah, it's a good motivation to keep trying.
Anyway. Yeah.
And what about the sort of the racial tensions or the racial climate?
That was a big part of it. Well, Hillsborough, I never experienced Hillsborough's racial climate till I bought the house here. Person County was classic kind of rural southern patronage system where every worth wild black person had a patron that would cover their back, so the cops would leave him alone and the rednecks would leave him alone, and that's his boy. And getting used to that was really kind of painful.
And this is in the 70s?
Yeah. Well, it still is. That's up at a friend's house, and his boy was cooking the chicken. It's just the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
It was shocking, and we had black neighbors. We lived, the house I bought was the westernmost slave quarter for the Cameron Plantation, Stagwell. And there were 1,500 slaves on this place at one time. And there's a slave graveyard out back, had over 300 graves in it. I went around trying to find somebody that would maintain the graves, and couldn't find any black church that would pick it up. I did find some guys that told me that they were there to bury the last person buried there in 1954. A slave lady died, and they said, "She's so mean, we buried her 10 feet deep."
That's crazy.
But our neighbors would not come to our house. Mm-hmm. You know, we'd invite them over for a party, and they wouldn't come. I couldn't figure that out until I asked one guy. There was one black dude who drove a cement delivery truck, and got to know him hanging around this country store where I was trying to get educated. And I asked him forthright one day, and I said, why won't my neighbors come in the house? They'll come to the back door, they'll stand out in the yard, but they won't come in the house. He said, if anything disappeared from your house, they'd be the first people the cops picked up. I said, okay, understood.
So thinking about, you know, the first time you came to Hillsborough and just the area of Person County included, how do you think from then, you know, to now you became someone that community members and people would sort of come to with preservation and local issues? How do you think you got involved with working on these sort of topics?
Well, it's what I do. It's my calling. I can't not want to save old things. I started actually going around to churches and at any meeting, any place where three or more would gather. I started doing this back in the 80s, trying to get the folks to preserve curing sheds. I heard an old man tell me about coming of age in the 1950s. And he said, you were a man when you were trusted to tend the fires on the curing shed. Because if those fires went out, you lost that shed. That was a lot of money. So when a young man was trusted to feed the fires while the old men drank and passed out, that was a coming of age moment. And every guy I talked to talked about that night. You know, they got the first sip of liquor. They got to sit up and listen to the old guys lie. Probably make a cross for tomorrow night. And it was very, very social. And I thought, gosh, this is such an important moment. How do you tell a kid about tending fires in a tobacco curing shed when there's no tobacco curing sheds to look at? How good are you at articulating a structure to the point where somebody will realize it? Mm-hmm. You gotta have the thing. And so I spent a couple of years just in my free time. I'd go get a gig at a church or something like that and say, you guys got to do something about this. You're losing your heritage.
Okay.
And once I started doing that, then I started, you know, people asked me to do other things like that. And so I wrote articles for the Pearson County Heritage books and was an editor on the Heritage book. And so all the blue hairs kind of forgave me for being a Yankee. And I taught a class up at Piedmont Tech called Why You Are Where You Are, and it was used just nothing but maps, historic maps, to show people the logic of locating settlements and why their families came to where they did.
So since you started doing, you know, this type of preservation work in the area, I suppose churches have been a big focus over the years.
Yes and no. I mean, that's a part of the South I've never really worked out. I mean, the churches have such mixed history, and so much of it is shameful that folks don't like to look at it, and they don't don't like to remember it. That's where we go for amnesia, I think, more than anything else. The church, the bliss the church produces is ignorance. And so many times you have to overcome so many falsehoods in order to even begin the conversation that it's not worth it. So I'll go to Rotary meetings and that level of society, but I've quit going to churches. I went around trying to get the town we were living in, Timberlake, didn't have a fire department. You had to have trucks come down from Hurdle Mill or over in Roxborough, 10 miles away to deal with a structure fire. And that's stupid. I was a fireman in California when I was working for the Navy, and realized that, your insurance rates go down when you have a fire truck nearby. And I took that message around to the churches, thinking, these folks are sensible. But no, they've been fighting this issue for 20 years because there were two families, and each one of them wanted the fire truck located at their site, and neither one of them could get enough support to beat the other one. So it just dangled for all that time. After I moved, they finally got a fire department.
Interesting. So, I think wrapping it up, let's talk a little bit about the Black Roads. In particular, how did you first of all, what is a Black Road? How would you describe
it? It's an abandoned right-of-way that was adopted by colored people, and I don't, the nomenclature of color is always frightened me because it's changed many times in my lifetime. But in fact, in Orange County, for example, there were Negro schools, there were colored schools, and there were white schools. And the colored schools were basically for the Native American population, or the blended population. And I don't think there were very many subcontinental Indians in North Carolina at the time. But at any rate, these were roads that were apparently used in lieu of traveling on public right-of-ways during Jim Crow. And it's apparently a rural phenomenon. And I say all of this apparently because I haven't really studied it. I stumbled on the subject. When I started the Trading Path, I got some good press. And first, anytime you get an article in the paper, people start calling you, "I got an old road in my yard," And this guy called me up and said, "Could you help us find our church?" And I said, "Geez, that'll depend on an awful lot. Where'd you lose it?" it turned out that what happened was in 1924, their church, the road that accessed their church, was taken off the maintenance list when they built a bridge over Seven Mile Creek west of Hillsborough.
And which church was this?
It was Harvey's Chapel.
Harvey's Chapel, right.
Yeah. And so I said, well, if approximately where people came from to get to the church, and kind of where the church was, we should be able to find the ford. And if we find the ford, we'll walk the road up to the church. And that's exactly what we did. It took us 2 hours one day. Wham, bam, thank you, ma'am. There was a cemetery, and they were happy as they could be.
What was your reaction to sort of finding this?
Oh, the hair always stands up my arms. Yeah. When it works. if you step into a moccasin path, I found a few. It's a thrill. Mm-hmm. It's a rush. I found there was you ever read William Byrd's History of the Dividing Line? If you get a chance, you can find it in used bookstores. It's a parallel text. Byrd was a 18th century, the Virginia Byrds, if you don't mind. And he was a rake and a Renaissance man, a good writer. And he kept a journal. Every time he boffed his wife, he'd make a journal entry on how they did it, where they did it and stuff. He was just kind of a weird fellow, and he kept a double journal during the survey of the North Carolina-Virginia border that he was assigned to, and one of them was for publication at the state government level. The other one was for his personal amusement, where he assigned names to all of the other surveyors and then just told the most horrible, scandalous stories about them. And the text you get today is parallel, so you can see where they are on any given day and what he's observing and so forth. And I followed his directions and thought, I said, you know, I bet he was right here when he made that observation. He said, after doing this, that, and the other thing, early in the afternoon, we found ourselves standing in the trail that the pack horsemen used to use. This is 1728. Pack horsemen are already out of business. And so I said, I bet I can find that. And it's long and short of it is, I did. I got a hold of the property owners. They gave me permission to trespass. And coming up out of Lake Gaston was a horse trail, just as clear as could be, you know. And that was a hair-raising moment.
Man, sounds really exciting.
Yeah.
So, see if I have anything else here. Is there anything else you want to add about, you know, your current occupation or the Black Roads in particular?
Well, the Black Roads thing, I hope, you know, I think Arwin Smallwood is interested, and I do hope that somebody looks at it carefully enough to see if there's substance there. I think there is, and I think the idea of using the highway commission and maintenance lists as a way of making life uncomfortable for undesirable populations has the ring of truth. That's the way I think Southern gentlemen would like to make it work, you know. Mm-hmm. Don't flog them, just make them so miserable you gotta leave, you know. And you know, some counties, like Davidson County, was a sunset county. They got rid of all of their minorities just wonderfully in just a few years in the 20s. That was the big movement down here, was to make life miserable so they'll leave.
Right.
And now we look on it as the Great Migration, when folks discovered the North. Now, I don't think so. It was a kick in the pants. Folks don't move unless someone boots them in the butt. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of, I think, what happened. But it'll be up to others to find the truth or falsehood of it. The Black Roads, again, it's intuitively right. Why would you want to share space with people that hate you and have a right to hurt you? White man hurts a black man, he's not going to get in trouble. Mm-hmm. And so it would be logical to find ways of moving that don't involve meeting white folks. And so I think there's truth in it. And the proof of it is that there's all these old roads that were, the abandoned right-of-ways had nothing but black infrastructure on them. Black churches, black schools, black stores on roads that were not on the maintenance list. So I've also heard them called the back way.
Back way.
The back way. If you talk to older black folks, they'll say, well, it's the back way.
Uh-huh.
And I tested it. Just, you know, I'm scientifically loose as any canon can be. And I gave talks at the National Genealogical Society for a couple of years, and I started asking black genealogists what they knew about black roads. It was wonderful. There was a group of five black ladies gaggling down the hall. And I stopped them. I said, can I ask you all a question? And they said, yeah. A little discomfort. And I said, what do you know about black roads? And this lady got really huffy, and she just kind of puffed up and got in my face. We don't know nothing about that. And another lady put her hand on her arm and said, now, you from the city? He said, yeah, this is the back roads. And she told me that, yeah, that's what we did. Anytime there was an abandoned right of way, we would move on to it, because that was the way you avoided having conflict with the rednecks.
Mm-hmm.
And the urban lady knew nothing about it. And I found, asking around Orange County, that the urban Hillsborough blacks knew nothing about it. But you go talk to anybody that grew up in rural Jim Crow, and they'll say, yeah.
And which event was this, where you met the
National Genealogical Society meeting?
Okay.
Down in Charleston. That's just a wonderful coincidence.
Yeah. So what do you think, because you detailed the process, I suppose, of sort of you know, I guess seeing how real this is, or just learning more about it from a sort of resource standpoint, what would need to be done, you think?
I think, well, somebody's going to have to find out where the archives are for the maintenance list, if that's going to happen. I think as a first step, we need to see if it really happened, and what you're doing this summer will probably produce either enough evidence that it did or enough evidence that it's not worth chasing. That is, interviewing the elders in these black churches and, you know, the black churches that have been forced to move. I have not found a white church that had its road cut off, but I've found three black churches, and they're all within 5 miles of Hillsborough. And all got their roads chopped about the same time. So I think it was an intentional device for applying the screws to undesired populations.
Okay.
But that's just my thoughts. I hope somebody can, you know, gather the evidence. It would be, you know, it's a shame that we're not interviewing the old Klansmen. I mean, we really need to talk to those Peckerwoods and find out exactly what was going on in their febrile minds, but it's not happening. Mm-hmm. We interview the victims and not the predators. I wonder if that's possible.
That's a good question. Okay, so is there anything else you want to add before we wrap it up?
I think if you all hook up with what's your name, the judge.
Beverly,
yeah. I saw her at this event where I spoke last weekend, and she's ready to help, and her family is so pervasive in the area around St. Mary's, mm-hmm. which is one of the churches, Lipscomb Grove Church, is one of them that was cut off and had to move, but they successfully reconstituted very close to their old church. Didn't work effectively that way. The one, I would do the deed work on the land between Moorfield, or between Dimmick Mill Road and Chestnut Ridge, and Highway 40, and golly, what is that? I can't remember the next main road that crosses between Chestnut Ridge and Orange Grove Road. All that property is, my impression, was part of two plantations, and the plantation foundation, the houses, foundations are amazingly large, the two that I've seen. And my understanding is that after the war, for whatever reason, the plantations were abandoned, and the property devolved on the slaves. It was a reconstruction effort of some kind. But the reconstruction records, the Freedmen's Bureau records, need to be scrubbed to find out if there's any visible evidence in there for this group. A list of the, you know, I talked to Harold about a list of the names of the people that used to live in there.
Harold?
I've sent his name in. You'll have to excuse me. That's worst possible situation. Okay. Historian with no memory. At any rate, you need to build a surname list of all the black families that farmed that land, mm-hmm. after the war, and build genealogies or family histories of them, because that's the biggest concentration. There was it's about 5 square miles of three ridge lines that were occupied by, I'm told, all black farmers, that got depopulated by the 1940s. They no longer could get to their property, and they were all gone. That land stayed fallow, stayed rank, and I don't know how it was acquired by the people that acquired it, but until about 20 years ago, people started building in there again. And now there's developers eyeballing it because it's a nice big parcel, and I'm sure there's people breathing hard to get a hold of it. But I would try to get these folks before they do like me and forget everything, and if find out who it was that lived in there, and then you do the usual census data and so forth. But
very good. Well, thank you, Tom.
Have fun.
Thanks, I'll try.
That was painless.